Thanks, Evan. All right, we are still in the exilic period, although we're starting to finish that up. Well, I mean, kind of, as if the exile ever really ended. But we're in the exilic period where they are still wrestling with the exile itself. The last date I gave you was 530, and I know I gave it to you rushed at the end. But at 530, Cyrus the Persian, Cyrus the Great, he dies. He dies. Now, what did Cyrus the Great also allow to start happening around 9 years earlier? The return and the beginning of the reconstruction of the temple. Okay? So he's the one that kickstarts that, but in 530, he dies. And his son, well, you don't really need to know his name, but it's Cambyses. His son takes power and gets a hearing with the Samaritans. Once there's a change of regime, a lot of times what you have is you have people going to the regime asking for a favor. That's normally what happens. And so the Samaritans go to Cyrus's son and they say, listen, we know they're rebuilding the temple and your dad thought that was a good idea, but here's the reason why it isn't a good idea. And they're causing division in this region. And do you really want this region to be divided given the fact that you have Egypt right down to the south? No. So how can you keep it unified? By stopping the rebuilding of the temple. And so that's what Cambyses actually decides to do, is to suspend rebuilding of the temple. It just so happens that at the suspension of the rebuilding of the temple it ends up stop rebuilding for about 9 years, okay? But during this 9 year period, because it won't kickstart back up again until around 520, there is a massive drought, massive famine in the land, which the prophets of Israel would say, and that's the reason why. It's because you're not allowing the temple to be rebuilt. So during this time period, this decade, there's a massive drought or famine in the region. And finally, after enough pressure, Cambyses decides to, he ends up allowing the Jews to begin rebuilding, even though the Samaritans were vehemently against it. And that's in around 520. 520, you see Haggai and Zechariah are exhorting the people to finish rebuilding the temple of, and the city of Jerusalem, but the temple in Jerusalem. So 520. Okay? No, 520 is when they begin to rebuild it again. Yep. So you have about a ten-year period where they're not allowed to rebuild the temple because Samaritans blocked it. Again, every time you see that interaction between the Samaritans and the Jews, it's laying down another block in this heated rivalry that will exist 500 years later with Christ. And so again, whenever you have this in the background and you come to a John chapter 4 with the woman at the well, or you, whenever the people of Samaria come out and they start saying that truly Jesus is the Savior of the world, that is a fascinating moment. That is a startling moment. Or when the hero in one of Jesus' parables is a Samaritan. And even at the end, remember at the end of the parable, wherever he asked him, he goes, so who was the neighbor? The answer is the Samaritan was. But what does the Jew say? The one that showed him mercy. He's evasive. He won't even say the name Samaritan. It goes back to things like this. That the Samaritans are the reason why the temple in Jerusalem almost wasn't rebuilt. They try to block it. So, 520, they start rebuilding. And in 515, the Jerusalem temple is completed. The Jerusalem temple is completed in 515. Not a ton happens. We're going to skip like almost 100 years. Not a ton happens in the next 70 years or so, but there is another pretty big event in 445. Okay? In 445, there is a request to, at the time, I'm not going to get into the name, but there's a request of the Medo-Persian Empire. At this point, it's no longer, Cambyses, it's Artaxerxes the First, but it doesn't matter. To request to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Now, that's a different request than the rebuild of the temple. To rebuild the temple is one thing. But when you start asking to rebuild the walls around the city, you're asking for the city to be fortified, to be protected, to, in a sense, the city itself be able to launch in a prolonged war and to defend itself. And if you are one of the kings that has subjugated this town, that's a gamble for you. Because if they start giving you trouble, they have greater fortifications and it could be more difficult on you to keep them under your thumb. You see the issue? So when 445, whenever they're asking, listen, can we rebuild the walls of Jerusalem? Artaxerxes I has to make a decision. Is there a political advantage for me to have them fortified, or will it cause me more problems? His response was, no, actually, that's something I'm okay with. I want you to do that. Why? Because he's having some major issues with Egypt starting to well up. Egypt down below is starting to cause a problem, and if you are the Persian Empire, which comes all the way over here, see the Tigris and the Euphrates. So this is kind of my terrible map on the board yesterday. This is the one that hopefully this will help. You see Mesopotamia right there with the Tigris and Euphrates. See Babylon down there. Over just beyond that, that's your Media. You see it up there in the middle of the screen? Media. So the Medo-Persian Empire is over in this region. How do you get over to this region? Remember this down here? That is all desert. That's all desert. So you're not really worried about them coming across there. There is your Jordan River right here. But it's up there, Syria and Armenia that are up at the top. That is the funnel for the whole region. That's the funnel. So if Egypt is going to invade from down here, they're going to sweep up through Jerusalem and then come over. That's what's going to happen. So Egypt's given him problems. What's the request down here in Jerusalem? We want to fortify our city. And he goes, yeah, that's probably a good idea. Why? Because as Egypt sweeps up, I don't want you switching allegiances. I want you staying with me. So if they sweep up, you'll even be able to fight them off and help me in the battle. So he grants their request to rebuild walls to create a stronger buffer between Egypt and the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay? Every time there's a decision made by a politician, they have to think it through that way. How is this going to benefit my agenda? It's not just benevolence. Okay? And so that's rebuilt. Now I'm going to talk, the reason why that's important is because what's going to happen in about 100 years. Okay? So next major date, now I'm going to give you a date. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to give you a date. I'm going to tie up a bow on this exilic period. Then we're going to summarize it by reading a text. And then we're going to take about 10 years before the date I'm about to give you, before that, and then run back at that date and then keep moving forward. Okay? So the date is this, 333, Alexander the Great defeats Darius III. The Persian dominance of the land of Israel is over. The Greek Empire has ascended. So 333, Alexander the Great defeats Darius III. Persian dominance of the land of Israel is over. It has ended. And now the Greek Empire is ascending. Which is crazy that that's in 333, but we'll get to that in a bit. So the Persians, they control the land of Israel from 548 or 538 all the way to 333. I mean, you're talking around just over 200 years. And honestly, it's 200 years of relative peace. Now, just because it is quote-unquote peace doesn't mean that it's something the Jews were enjoying. Peace just means they weren't in war. But it doesn't mean that they're like, this is delightful, how wonderful. So don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But they are relatively 200 years of peace. The question, though, is why did this happen? Like, we just summarized the exilic period, and we're about ready to move deep into the intertestamental literature, because we've even been kind of on the edge of the Old Testament at times. Some of the events we're talking about are still being brought up. We're about ready to dive deep into the intertestamental literature, the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. But why this whole exile happens to begin with is persistently told to us throughout the prophets. But I want to read to you Isaiah chapter 1, which, you know, I mean, I would put it up as a top three candidate of the most vicious text in the Old Testament. I would put it up there. It is frightening. Now, I mean, there's some images later on in Isaiah that are just dreadful. But what God says here in Isaiah 1 is pretty overwhelming. It begins in Isaiah. We're going to say, I'm going to begin in verse 4, although we'll go back and read verses 2 and 3 later. But Isaiah 1, verse 4, "Woe to the sinful nation, a people whose guilt is great, a brood of evildoers, children given to corruption. They have forsaken the Lord. They have spurned the Holy One of Israel and turned their backs on Him. Why should you be beaten anymore? Why do you persist in rebellion? Your whole head is afflicted. Your whole heart afflicted. From the sole of your feet to the top of your head, there is no soundness, only wounds and welts and open sores, not cleansed or bandaged or soothed with olive oil. Your country is desolate. Your cities burned with fire. Your fields are being stripped by foreigners right before you, laid waste as when overthrown by strangers. Daughter Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard, like a hut in a cucumber field, like a city under siege. Unless the Lord Almighty had left us some survivors, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been like Gomorrah. Now hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom." He's not talking to Sodom. Isaiah is talking to the people of God, but he calls them Sodom. You don't want that on your resume. That's not good. "Listen to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. The multitude of your sacrifices, what are they to me, says the Lord? I have more than enough burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fattened animals. I have no pleasure in the blood of bulls and lambs and goats. When you come to appear before me, who has asked this of you, this trampling of my courts? Stop bringing meaningless offerings. Your incense is detestable to me. New moons, Sabbaths, and convocations, I cannot bear your worthless assemblies. Your new moon feasts and your appointed festivals, I hate with all of my being. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands in prayer, I hide my eyes from you. Even when you offer many prayers, I am not listening to you. Why? Your hands are full of blood. Wash and make yourselves clean. Take your evil deeds out of my sight. Stop doing wrong. Learn to do right. Seek justice. Defend the oppressed. Take up the cause of the fatherless. Plead the case of the widow." Why did the exile happen? Do you hear this in Isaiah 1? I mean, the exile happened eventually because God's going, "I'm done with your rebellion. I'm turning my back. And I'm allowing whatever happened, happen." But there's a reason why he gets to the point where he says, "Your new moon festivals, all this is a bunch of junk. I don't care about any of this." He gets to this point. Part of it is because if you think about it, even whenever he talks about their prayers, "When you turn to me and pray, I do not listen." Why? Well, when they would pray, they don't do this like we do. They don't close their hands and close their eyes. What do they do? If a Jew is praying, they're doing this. They spread out their hands before God, and he says, "When you pray to me and I look at your hands, what are they covered in? The blood of the very people I asked you to fight for." Read the Old Testament law. It's startling about the way God instructs them to take care of the oppressed, the poor, the orphan, the widow, the foreigner, stranger in your land. My goodness. If the church would just read the Old Testament law, it might help us with some immigration or refugee issues. We don't even need to read the New Testament. Like, my word. I mean, the way the Old Testament is emphatic. Even somebody just passing through your land, you're to take care of them. That the Sabbath is for the slave, the foreigner, and the refugee in the Old Testament. I mean, it's amazing to me when it comes to politics. Israel does this too, by the way. The Christians in America, we just like chuck theology. And whatever pundit that we, you know, decide to align ourselves with, that's just we're going to become their parrot and just say whatever they say. Forget what the Old Testament law says. Forget even what Jesus does. Forget the New Testament calls us foreigners and strangers in this land. We've laid stake to a land and we're going to protect it with everything, even if it means forsaking the least of these. That's just what we've done. But the reason why the exile began is because Israel was doing stuff like that. Like, just let that sink in a moment. The reason why Isaiah gives, this is the very beginning of Isaiah, which is an entire book, talking about the rebellion of Israel that is involved in the exile. And it begins by saying, why is there a problem? Because when you come to me, you have the blood on your hands of the very people I asked you to defend, to take care of. But it is deeper than that. As a matter of fact, I talk about this in my biblical justice class. I was like, yeah, don't get off that easy as far as biblical justice stuff. See, if you had just done the justice stuff, that would have been fine. It's bigger than that. It's bigger than that. Why? It goes all the way back to verses 2 and 3. The way that this begins, this vicious text begins, this frightening text begins, verses 2 and 3 of Isaiah 1 says this, "Hear me, you heavens. Listen, earth, for the Lord has spoken. I reared children and brought them up, but they have rebelled against me." I mean, the ox knows its master, but my children don't know me. The donkey knows its owner's manger, but my children don't know me. But Israel, they don't know. My people do not understand, let me insert what he's saying, who I am. They don't have a clue who I am. I mean, if they knew who I was, there is no way they would come to me with blood on their hands. No way. The reason why they come in with blood, the reason why they're forsaking orphans and widows and the poor and the foreigners and the refuge, the reason why they're doing that is because they do not know me. Because if they knew me, they would realize when they walk up like this, that that's not who I am, and therefore I'm going to respond to that with the way that my character responds to that, and that is with what verses 4 through 17 articulate. You know, it's like somebody coming up to me, and because I have long hair, you know, talking to me about them being anti-God and, you know, and them smoking pot and like, you know, come on, man, you just like us, right? You don't know me. Because if you did, there's no way you would come to me talking about that. That makes no sense. It's kind of like several years ago, I had some students that I was investing in, and long story short, come to find out, they were at a wedding and decided that even though they were students at Ozark and under contract, they were going to drink. And they kind of thought like that I would be okay with it as if I'm okay with rule breaking. And I basically told them, I was like, you don't even know me. Yeah, we've spent a couple of years, me investing in you, you don't even know me. And it was a really tense time with them. I just said, I have nothing to say to any of you. It's like, because if you think I'm okay with you breaking rules like that, then apparently you don't know me and I sure don't know you. And I just told him, I was like, you know what? I just need you to go. I just need you to go. Just get out. It's like, because I'm afraid I'm going to say something to you I don't want to say. Now, to their credit, they ended up going straight from that meeting, all of them, over to Monty and confessing. But there was a part of that where I just said, listen, in order for discipleship to work, the number one thing you got to do is know the person that's actually discipling you. It's the same thing when it comes to God. If you're going to claim to be a Christ follower, the first thing you need to do is to get to know who Christ is really well. If you're going to claim to be the people of God, Israel, the first thing you probably should do is figure out who God is. And if you think that our God is a God that's okay with oppression and subjugation or ignoring of the least of these, the orphans, the widows, the poor, the thirsty, the naked, the hungry, those that are in prison, those that are refugees or immigrants, if you think that's who our God is, that he's okay with division on race lines or discrimination in ways that we could just fabricate, if you think that's who our God is, that we stop pursuing people because they're inconvenient, that we're looking to kick people out of church more than we are trying to figure out a way to get people in, if you think our God's okay with dividing churches over worship wars and carpet color, you don't know who he is. And the consequence of not knowing who he is, and in his name still functioning, is exile. Isaiah 1 is saying this. You don't know who I am, so let me say it again. Chapter 9. I am the Prince of Peace. I am Emmanuel. I am a mighty counselor, a mighty warrior. Let me tell you who I am. In all, Isaiah 53. I am a suffering servant. He's reintroducing himself. But if the people of Israel were really listening, they would have seen this all the way before in their history. What was the Exodus? I heard your oppression, and I came to set you free. Let me give you my law. What is the law? Read Leviticus. The law is a reflection of God's heart, fighting for the people that no one wants to fight for. I mean, my goodness, and we could add the New Testament. John 1:18, Jesus is an exegesis. That's what the word that he uses there in 1:18. He exegetes God. Who is God? Jesus has exegeted him for us. That's who God is. As a matter of fact, Hebrews says he is the exact representation of God's being. Colossians 1:15, he is the image of the invisible God. Or John 14, if you have looked at me, you have seen the Father, because I and the Father are one. 2 Corinthians 3, his face is the radiance of God. If you still don't know who God is, at what point does God just say, I don't know what else to do? I don't know what else to do to get through to you who I am. Give you a law, articulate in as many words as I can. Have my word become flesh and dwell among you. Send you one third of the Trinity. Like, what do you want me to do? Sometimes it is amazing to me that Christians are surprised by basic Christ-like things like Christianity 101. It blows my mind that it's controversial in the church to talk about loving people that have no money. How is that controversial? To talk about people that have been kicked out of their home by a vicious, oppressive warlord, that we're going, get out of here. How is this controversial for the church? How is this even an issue? Well, but do you know what it'll cost us? Yeah, what it cost Jesus to save your tail. It'll cost us the same thing. How is this shocking that this is what we're supposed to do? If anyone is to come after me, must deny himself, take up his cross, then follow me. How does it surprise us that loving the people that the world doesn't love doesn't cost us a cross? I'm not understanding this. I mean, it's amazing to me. The most that people get riled up to me outside of the rapture, the most people get riled up with me is whenever I start talking about wanting to love people like the least of these and not wanting to kill people like my enemies. Christians get the most upset with me when I talk about one of those two issues, which is weird to me. I mean, sometimes I'm sitting there just like, what am I even saying that's controversial? I don't even understand. Don't quote to me the Sermon on the Mount. Like, that's what you're telling me? I mean, like, what if the church took the Sermon on the Mount seriously? What would our churches look like? What would our conversations be like? But there's a part of it where we've even done stuff like this. Oh, the Sermon on the Mount's about individual ethics. It's just not about stuff like, you know, national ones. Man, we just figure out all kinds of fun ways to get around the words of Jesus that are so blatant and obvious. It'd be almost like Israel saying, oh, I mean, what God's talking about there is on a national level, just not an individual one. He doesn't seem to be functioning like that. He seems to say, what is the group if it is not individuals? And what is an individual if they are not a part of a group? I mean, the exile doesn't just come out of nowhere because they broke a bunch of piddly laws. The exile comes because their heart was not turned toward God because they either knew him and rejected him or they did not know him even though he was trying to yell it at them. There's only two options there. They either saw who God was and says, we want something different. Or for some amazing way, they did not see who he was. And my question is church, are we doing the same thing? Are we doing the same thing? Like, where does our allegiance really lie? And isn't that a question we should talk about a little bit more? I mean, I get really concerned with not just the rhetoric inside the church, but with the Christian representation on social media outside of the church. I get very concerned. So, for example, the day after Obama's election, second term, I looked on Facebook. I know, that was stupid, but I did. And there's a lady that was a Christian that I know, but I won't tell you her name, was saying, last night when I heard the news, I cried myself to sleep. I was just so overwhelmed. I'm so afraid. I cried myself to sleep. And I didn't comment because that's usually foolish to respond to anything on social media outside of happy birthday. But what I wanted to say was, when's the last time you cried yourself asleep about the souls that are dying and going to hell? When's the last time you cried yourself to sleep about the orphans and the widows that have no one to fight for them? When's the last time you cried yourself to sleep about the children that don't know Jesus that are caught in sex trafficking? Like, when's the last time you cried yourself to sleep about the things that God is actually weeping over? An election? You know, and now we're 4.5 years later, and I'm going, was it worth crying yourself to sleep over? Because guess what? America's pretty much the same as it always was. But how is your weeping affected the refugees that have nowhere to go? Usually people get, whenever they're at the point where they're crying themselves to sleep, it's because they are so bought into making something change that they are brought to the point of tears. And I'm going, when are we going to have a generation of people that are weeping for what the church is? And to cry themselves asleep and refuse to allow the church to continue to walk down the path that only leads to an exile. I mean, when are we going to, this is one of the things, that this next Sunday I'm preaching on speaking against culture. And one of the things I'm like, this sermon could get pretty awkward because when you look at who Jesus speaks against talking about culture, he is not rowdy with the tax collector. He is not rowdy with the sinner. He's not rowdy with the woman caught in adultery or the woman at the well that is scandalous. He's rowdy at the people that know better. He's the most rowdy with the people that claim to be the people of the God and should know better. Where he looks at their actions, he compares it to the cross, and he says, I find you lacking. That's who he's the most upset with. So part of what I'm even saying this Sunday is like, if I actually match Jesus' tone and his ministry as speaking against culture, this could get really awkward. Because usually when people talk about speaking against culture, it's about them out there, all those idiots that are wrong. If we were doing our job, it would, in some sense, silence a lot of the conversation that's around us. But instead, we're not. We're enhancing the craziness with our actions and our words. We're allowing them to dictate the conversation of the culture. Instead of us living and speaking in such a way where it silences the foolishness, it enhances grace. The church is just kind of forgotten. I don't know if it's we've forgotten who we are, but we have definitely forgotten who the enemy is. We've gotten that mixed up. So I've done it once before, but I've changed the pictures, and they're always a little more explosive when you do it. But at the very end, I'm doing this little thing where I just give them a picture lesson and remind them of who the enemy is. So I show this really nasty picture of Satan, and I just say, this is your enemy. And then I say, this is not, and then a picture of a gay pride parade will come up. And I'll say, this is your enemy, it's Satan. This is not, and it's the Pope. This is your enemy, Satan. This is not, and it's Trump. This is your enemy, Satan. This is not, and it's cops and riot gear. This is your enemy, Satan. This is not, and it's a Black Lives Matters parade or protest. This is your enemy, Satan. This is not, and it's a refugee line. This is your enemy. This is not, and it's somebody sitting in a pew. Because we just forget who the enemy is. When you forget who the enemy is, you forget how to fight. When you forget who the enemy is, in some sense, you also forget what it is that Jesus actually came to accomplish and how he accomplished it. When Jesus was hanging on a cross, he wasn't thinking, we've lost. He was thinking, the true enemy has been devoured. And if you target Satan, and if you go at him with the weapons of Christ, all of the other brokenness that are represented in any way, shape, or form in those other pictures will be taken care of. We're treating symptoms, guys. We're not going at the actual thing that needs a surgery. Satan is the target. So how do you fight him? A person that you can't picket line over. How do you fight against him? A person you can't swing at or tear gas. How do you fight against Satan? By living your life in the shape of a cross. By figuring out who Jesus is and then becoming that. Through the power of the Holy Spirit. Allowing yourself to be emptied, kenosis, so that God can fill you up with his image. But the problem is, we keep going to God with our hands stretched out in prayer with blood on them. And God's patient. It was hundreds of years of rebellion before he finally led into exile. We've already talked about that. But why? Why go on sinning so that grace can increase? I mean, shall we keep sinning? Come on, this is Paul. By no means. If you know who God is and if you know who he's asking you to become, then what are we waiting on? I mean, this is Romans 12. Becoming a living sacrifice. What is a living sacrifice? I'll give you at least one example. Someone hanging on a cross. They're a living sacrifice. What is he calling them to in chapter 12? To be transformed into the shape of the one that you are worshiping. We're talking about this in Revelation. In Revelation, worship is war. Why? Because who you worship, you become. That's why. The book of Revelation, you worship, you become. It's not an accident that those that belong to the Lamb are characterized with the same colors and the same language and the same adjectives as the Lamb. And it's not an accident that those that belong to the unholy Trinity, Satan and his minions, they're characterized exactly with the same colors, the same titles, and the same adjectives. It's not an accident. Who you worship, you become. But the church has found this weird way right now. And I'm saying this in broad terms, knowing that I'm talking to the current and future church leaders that will have an opportunity to re-steer the ship. In many ways, the church, especially in the public forum, the church has found a way to claim to be worshiping Jesus, but to be speaking like a dragon. That must stop. It must change. And how does that change? Individual transformation will actually influence the masses, which is the reason why Christ died for you, resurrected, ascended, and sent the Holy Spirit to transform you. Your job, empty yourself. That's your job. To do what Christ did. Emptied himself. Philippians 2.
did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, but he emptied himself, kenosis. And how does chapter 2 of Philippians begin? Or at least that section in verse 6? Have the same attitude as that of Christ Jesus. You know, I mean, this is 1 John 2:6. If anyone claims to be a follower of Jesus, he must walk as Jesus walked. I mean, it's not like I'm talking about one passage. It's Old and New Testament saying the same thing. You don't know who I am, and you're not functioning like me. And that only leads one direction, away from me, into an exile. This is the thing that's interesting too, is like the church is always constantly trying to wrestle with the question of relevancy. And we've missed it. It's not the way you dress. It's not the clothes you wear. It's not the light shows that you can conjure. It's not even the ability to preach. I promise you, healing will always be relevant to someone that is sick and broken. I promise. Figure out how to become the healer, the hands and feet of the healer. Figure out how to lead them. Figure out how to lead them there by you yourself going there. I really wish. I got to make sure I'm careful how I say this. I am confident that here in the near future, Ozark will make some changes regarding counseling. Because I believe, and I'm going to push, and I'm doing the best I can to work out a way, that every freshman is required to go through a semester of counseling on the school's dime. We can do this. Why? Because we need to have 4 years of you all being transformed in the likeness of Christ. Because whenever you have walked the hell of personal transformation, you're able to lead people there a lot better. Now, there are counselors available to you even right now. But I'm like, I'm one of those, but we can do more. We can do more. It should not be any hoops. It should not be confusing or difficult. You shouldn't even have to ask me. Now, how do we get counseling? You shouldn't even have to ask me. It should be the norm. No one should feel shame going to a counselor because that's just what everybody does when they want to get healthy. I've done counseling multiple times in my life, and I'll probably do it again soon. Why? Because it's like, I mean, do you go to a doctor every once in a while for a checkup? What are you doing for your soul? We're obsessed with taking care of our bodies. When it comes to our soul and our psyche and our emotions, it's like we treat it like, oh, it'll take care of itself. That's even more complicated than your body. And we have this diet of just like straight Snickers and Coke for our soul. And we're like, I wonder why we're so sick. Because your soul hasn't seen a piece of fruit, irony, or vegetable in a long time. Like, we're just not even hydrating ourselves. We don't even know how to do it. We don't even know where the well is. Like, oh, we claim to be following the one that is living water. We just don't even know how to get a drink from him. It's like, man, we've got to take our own personal transformation more seriously in the church if we want the church to be different. And that comes with pain, vulnerability, understanding and being able to look and see the language of shame and call it out when it exists. Saying, no, you're not going to talk about yourself like that. My kids, whenever they will, quote unquote, get in trouble, if they say stuff like, man, I'm just terrible. No, you are not terrible. You may have done a terrible thing, but that can always be undone. When they say, I am terrible, there's a problem with that because that's an identity statement that says, that is who I am and I cannot be different. That's never true. I'm just dumb at math. I'm just terrible at math, my son says. I'm like, no, you're not. You just have to work harder at it. That's okay. You can do that. You can change that. It's fine. We're used to this. Pay attention to that. Listen to the language you use or other people use. That person's an idiot.
No, they may have done an idiotic thing, but they are not necessarily by default an idiot.
What is that? What am I describing?
Shame.
And the Bible is very clear. Christ came to take away your guilt and your shame so that you no longer get to define who your identity is. He defines it. And he says, oh, no, you're not an idiot. You're a co-heir in the kingdom. You are the body of Christ. You are the temple of God. You are my hands and feet. You are sons and daughters of a king. That's who you are. Why? Because I also took your shame. You don't get to hold on to either one. Guilt or shame, I get both. If we just knew who he was, we'd realize even the things that we think are controversial are really the language of life and love. It's the deep wisdom of God that's been revealed through the mystery of Christ on the cross. And I look forward to your generation reclaiming that.
Love you guys. See you on Tuesday.